Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman, who is here to answer your questions about the moon, the sun, and anything else in our universe. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question for Bob, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman. Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. And if you have a question for Bob Berman, call us now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. Somebody just emailed a car question. Alas, that's not the question you want to ask Bob, but maybe he can answer it. If you want to do an astronomy question, however, he's got a pretty good shot. It's voxpop@wamc.org, and the number is 800-348-2551. Mr. Bob Berman, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Ray. And yourself?
I am doing very well. I saw an item on space.com today, and immediately I knew that you'd want to talk about this. It is now 3 years from today that the huge solar eclipse will be happening.
That's right. I didn't realize that. And it's going to be one in our neighborhood, our listening area. In fact, but it's very important, again, that people not be complacent and just go to their backyard and see a partial eclipse. I know we say this before every major total eclipse. There's just something that happens during a total solar eclipse that makes it different. Makes it different from any kind of lunar eclipse, makes it different from a partial solar eclipse. It's on a different world. People, now that I've led expeditions to see 10 of them over the last bunch of decades, I can tell you, people weep. That's how touched. People are blown backwards by it. It surpasses, I think, every other visual experience. So you got to see it for yourself. You don't need eye protection for the total part. It's not that you need goggles or anything. And so if you want to, we can get to that later, but it's going to be a narrow strip in our listening area that will see it as total. Most of our listening area, it'll just be partial, and that's when you do need the eye protection. And when the stars don't come out, the geysers of pink flames don't come from the edge of the sun during a partial part. Yeah, so hopefully everybody will travel, because it's just a little bit of a drive for us, for all of us in our listening area, to see this total eclipse coming up in a few years.
Right, and it'll be north, I guess, in the Adirondacks. It sort of swoops in from New Mexico, am I going the wrong direction? From the Adirondacks down to the southwest, one way.
No, you're right. It comes up from Mexico, up from Texas, and then the narrow path of totality, it's only about 100 miles wide, like a ribbon, we'll go over Cleveland, Buffalo, Rochester, and then continue to the northeast to eventually go over Burlington.
Yep.
And then over New Hampshire and into Maine. So in our area, it'll be areas around Lake Champlain on both sides, the New York and the Vermont side, and Burlington are the best bets. Or, again, places like Rochester and Buffalo.
Well, it's a few years away. Now, when was the last one? Time is I'm very much like Einstein now. Time is very relative. It seems like it was a couple of days ago. But the last solar eclipse in North America was how long ago now?
Well, it was only December 4th of this few months ago in Chile. Unfortunately, this event was... actually, this was the 14th. The one coming up will be the 4th of December. And because of COVID, unfortunately, Chile closed their borders, and we were not able to bring our group to Chile a couple of months ago to see that one.
Alas, I wasn't referring to the one there. I was referring to the one here. How long ago was that?
Oh, that was in 2013. That was in August, in late August of 2013.
Ah, and, really? That long ago?
Yeah. The year just
holy mackerel. Well, you know, it was quite a show. My point is the media coverage, and you really got a chance. Even if you were not there, you watched it live on TV, and you watched people's reaction, and it was very strong. So hopefully this one in 3 years from today will, you know, those of us who missed the last one will get a chance. Bob Berman is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Before we get to the phones, Bob, and any potential car questions that you may have to answer, what constellations should I be looking for? We've been out looking. The weather has been beautiful. And we have been out looking at the sky and just noting how things have moved, the Pleiades and such, from the dead of winter to where they are now. What constellations are making appearances now that we'll be on the lookout for?
Yeah, quite right. And this is a time when they change most rapidly, because it's sort of like two warring armies, where the sun, as we all know, is now setting later and later, and the stars always set 4 minutes earlier every night. So they're going in opposite directions. And because of that, the winter constellations are rapidly disappearing. And so we still see Orion. At nightfall in the west, there is Orion, and the famous belt of Orion points left to the brightest star in the sky, the Dog Star, which is beautifully seen these nights. But again, like you say, these are the final weeks of that, because it's gone. We're going to be replacing with a much less brilliant spring sky.
What is the collection of stars that are up there right now that look very much like a bow and arrow? And I don't think this has anything to do with Orion. It almost looks like a cross straight up, let's see, to the west, I guess, maybe southwest. And it really caught our eye. I've never really noticed that one before. Is that Cygnus?
Well, I wish we were out together. Yes, Cygnus does look the way you describe it. Cygnus is not out now.
Okay, well, then
I wish we were out together with a laser pointer, because people are often saying, I see a square or a circle or a cross, and they're putting together stars,
right,
maybe from adjacent constellations that could be, they may be putting together small groupings or large groupings, and I don't know how they're assembling them, but if I can only be standing with them as they point, then I can answer that.
Okay, so, well, it's enormous. I mean, it takes up a large portion of the sky. It's four stars, I think, and maybe I'll try to snap a shot. They're so bright that I should be able to get some for you. Bob Berman is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's grab a call or two before the first break. David is in Medusa. David, you're up.
Hi, I just wanted to ask two fast questions. I'm moving to the South Pacific. I bought a Celestron Nexstar 8 SE.
Mm-hmm, yeah, good
computerized. Yeah, so are there any bells and whistles that I should, you know, get with it that you think would be useful? And
make sure you have the right eyepieces for it, because sometimes the telescope only comes with one or two. So make sure you have a good low power. Low power is more useful than high power. So the number on the eyepiece should be 30 or 35 millimeter, and that'll give you your low power. And good eyepieces these days are at least $100 each. I won't mention brands, because that's sort of our policy here on public radio, not to do particular brands. But, you know, a $35 or a $50 eyepiece is usually not very good, meaning the field of view is small and you're not getting a wide field and the optics are not really that great. So, yeah, make sure you at least have one 30 or 35 millimeter eyepiece that costs at least $100. Good ones can even be $300 or $400.
Yeah.
And the other eyepieces that came with it, I'm sure will be just fine. That's the most important sort of bell and whistle, as you've said.
Yeah, it just comes with a 25 millimeter.
Well, 25 is pretty good. You may want to get a what's called a Barlow lens, and that will double the magnification on that and effectively then give you a 12 millimeter eyepiece. So you might want to get a 35 millimeter plus a Barlow lens, and then you'll have, in effect, four eyepieces, and that should set it up just fine. And remember, telescopes are great, but as Ray was saying earlier, there's nothing like some of the great natural phenomena that you don't need a telescope for. He was talking about eclipses like that great one we just had a couple of years ago in 2017, and we'll have another one coming up in 2024 here in America. It's an unusual time for total solar eclipses, and then meteor showers. This summer we'll have the best one in years because the moon will be not interfering.
I mean, every time, with all due respect, every time I see a prediction from a scientist saying, oh, yeah, this is going to be the best meteor shower ever, it either rains or there are three meteors. So how can you predict?
You're right. But one of the problems is that there's about two dozen meteor showers a year that are minor. And by minor, it means that instead of the background rate of 6 an hour, because that's how many you'll see any night, especially between midnight and dawn when they're more numerous, you'll see about 6 an hour. So what does a meteor shower mean? Well, if it boosts it from 6 an hour to 12 an hour, it'll be called a meteor shower, but is it really worth setting the alarm and getting up for an extra few meteors an hour? And that's why we really look for the major showers, of which there are only two or three. And then you'll see 60 an hour, meaning one a minute. And then the Perseids every year on August 11th, the night to August 11th or 12th, that's a great one. And the only thing you watch out for is it close to a full moon, because the moon will wash out the meteors. But if you have a year like this one, where the moon won't be big and near full and interfering, you're perfect. Okay. And then the other great meteor shower are the Geminids every December 13th. Same thing, one meteor a minute. Once every 33 years, we have the Leonids, which could give us five meteors a minute. We had a great one in 2001 around here.
Ah.
So those are the big ones.
All right. Well, listen, we lost David halfway through that, and we have to take a break here in about 15 seconds. But, David, you wanted to follow up real quick?
Yeah, just the second part was, I'm up near Albany. Is there any club up here or whatever that I could go and check out to basically learn more about this before I leave?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Albany Astronomy Club. I don't have a number handy for me to look up, but there is a very nice club. You could contact Alan French or Sue French, who are very active. I think they're the president and vice president, so their numbers are listed. That would be a good way to contact them. And you're absolutely right. A local astronomy club, that's great, because then you can hang out with them, and they've got lots of telescopes set up.
Yeah.
And you can even get a lot of good tips on how to use them and what maybe could be good accessories and that kind of thing.
Do astronomers generally bring beer to these events, Pop?
Bring what? I lost that word.
Do they bring beer?
Oh.
No.
That's funny. You know, I've never had a glass of beer in my whole life.
All right, well, let's leave it there and we'll take a break.
In college I tasted it once and it was so horrible tasting that I've never had another.
Well, I'm sorry I brought it up. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. More astronomy, etc. Bob Berman joins us today. It's Astronomy on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob, who has never had beer in his life. This is the breaking news here on WAMC. Amazing. Truly. I would have pegged you for someone, maybe like an IPA once in a while. Hey, but before we get to the next call, we talked about telescopes. And one thing, I mean, we're out every night that there's a nice night and we look at the stars. It's just what we do in my house. Telescopes, I'm terrible with a telescope. Is there a type of binoculars I should look for? Those I seem to be pretty good with.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because those are great instruments, not just for terrestrial use, like bird watching or spying on neighbors or whatever you want to use
right.
it for terrestrially, but a lot of astronomy is better with binoculars than through a telescope. For example, the famous Seven Sisters or Pleiades star cluster. It's a knockout through binoculars, and the Milky Way is nothing better than binoculars. And so what type? You can either go cheap or expensive.
Right.
Like for only about $30, there are some excellent, inexpensive binoculars. Can I mention a brand, or should I not?
You can, but I already have the cheap ones. I'm looking for something that, like, specs. What magnification? What am
All
I
right.
looking
okay,
for?
Okay, so we'll do both. In the cheap part, the Celestron G2 or Go2 binoculars, I think they're so well made. The images are so good for about $30. And you have a choice. A good magnification is anything 7, 8, up to 10 power.
Okay.
That is the first number. You don't want more than that, because then your hand will just make the image wiggle, and then you need a tripod, and you really don't want to bother with a tripod. So
okay, so no more than
sure
10.
Make sure the first number is 7, 8. There seem to be no 9 power binoculars. So 7, 8, or 10. That's the thing to look for.
Okay.
Or now you jump up to at least $500, if not $14, and get the image-stabilized binoculars, which are the best. And there, you press a button, and there are gyros that steady the image so that we all have a natural shaking of our hand, and that goes away so that the image is so perfectly rock-steady that you see more detail than you could ever observe through a regular binocular. So those are the image-stabilized models. Canon makes a whole bunch of them,
yeah.
And you can't say enough about them.
Okay, so that's what I'm going to save up for at my current salary. That will be 3 years. So we'll talk about it soon. Let's go to Kit in Westfield, Massachusetts. Kit, you're on.
Hi, you guys. Hey, Bob, I just want to... you started talking about the eclipse, and I just got to throw out a huge thanks to you for recommending searching out a place to go to see one. You recommended going out west, and that's what we did, and we hit it dead nuts.
Dead nuts. Where'd you go, Kit?
We went out near Cheyenne.
Oh, beautiful.
Wyoming, in the Bow Medicine National Forest. We just, you know, camped out. It was free, and, you know, there were 100 other nomads out there.
Cool.
I mean,
and you had clear weather, I think, didn't you?
It was bluebird to dark as night. It was, other than watching my kids being born, it was the most awesome
ever. Oh, that's
ever.
Great.
Great. So I hope everybody's listening to that. Remember, you want the total solar eclipse, not a partial solar, not a total lunar, not a partial lunar. Of all the different kinds of eclipses, total solar eclipse. They're rare because they only happen once every 360 years for each given spot on Earth. So if you want to wait for one to come to you, except for this one coming up in 2024, normally you have to wait. This very recent one that we had in 2017, I know somebody just pointed out that I've said both 2017 and 2013 for
yes.
that recent one. It was 2017, August 21st. But it's rare to have one around in America or near us. So usually you have to travel.
We have one of our kids lives in Burlington, Vermont.
Oh, that's the place.
What do you think about cloud cover?
Well, the problem with early April around here, everybody who lives here knows that in early April, even though it's going to be mid-afternoon, which is not a bad time of day to be looking, it's probably going to be a 50-50 shot at that. That's why, for example, our tour group is going to be going down to southern Texas for that, just to increase the chances of seeing clear weather. But, you know, why travel? If you live near here, even if it's only a 50-50 shot, and especially you have relatives in Burlington, you say, well, I mean, you got to do that.
Yes. Kit, thanks a lot for the call. The weather has been, the skies have been so clear the last several nights. It has been remarkable for April. So, It's a shame there isn't a meteor shower going on right now that I could see.
Yeah, but not much. For reasons that nobody understands, the meteors have been skewed toward the second half of the year. And it's not just the major showers. Remember, I mentioned we've got the Perseids in August and the Geminids in December. And those times that the Orionids are good, that's October. And the Leonids are in November when they come up. Usually only every 33 years they get good, but they are on the night of November 18th. So you can see a pattern there. They're all in late summer or fall. The first half of the year, like we're in now, there are only minor meteor showers. And not only that, the background rate of meteors. Remember I mentioned that we get 6 an hour normally on any clear night? Well, those are fewer during the first half of the year right now than they are in the last half of the year. So we definitely have a bias calendar-wise towards more meteors in the second half of the year.
Bob Berman is our guest. It's Astronomy Today. The number is 800-348-2551, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Ed is in Tilson. Ed, you're on.
Hello. Yeah, hi there. I will echo that the 2017 eclipse, we went to Tennessee for that got a spot right in the path. It was great. And in 2024, I'm going to go up to my camp in Maine and just have to drive maybe an hour north from there to be there for that.
Fantastic.
Total eclipse.
Good. And mm-hmm. And would you agree, am I exaggerating, just for our listeners, or would you agree that the solar totality is among the most amazing things the eye can see?
Absolutely. I had to lie down while I was watching it. I was on a slight incline, little hill, so it was perfect. I could just lie there and, like, stare straight at it and realize I'm looking straight at the sun for 2 straight minutes, you know, no glasses or anything. So
yeah, I don't know what happens when the sun and the moon and your spot on Earth form a straight line in space. I'm convinced that a blind person would be able to feel the power of it. I know this doesn't sound scientific, but there's just something that happens that, you can read about in James Fenimore Cooper's essay called The Eclipse. He was writing about the great 1806, I believe it was, eclipse in Cooperstown. But through the or Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, of course, the famous Mark Twain book, mm-hmm. but everyone who describes it just goes crazy about it. And you don't get that from lunar eclipses, partial or total. There's just something that happens.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask about Mars. You know, I've been watching Mars a lot of nights ever since August. I was able to see it rising in the evening. And now it's, getting close to setting in the evening. And a few weeks ago, there was this beautiful line of 3 red lights. We had, you know, Betelgeuse in Orion and Aldebaran in Taurus, and then Mars. It was a straight line, and it's not straight anymore because of, you know, where Mars is. And I just don't understand. I might need to see a model of it sometime. What does retrograde mean? It's just how we see Mars, where we see it, but what does it mean?
Well, it just means that all the planets circle the sun in the same direction. That is counterclockwise, if you're north of the solar system looking down at it. And very simply put, the planets closer to the sun, because of the sun's stronger gravity, whip around the planets at faster speeds. So the fastest moving planet is Mercury, second fastest is Venus, next fastest is Earth. And that means that Earth moves faster than Mars. So as we pass Mars, which we do every 2 years and 2 months, Mars seems to slip backwards, just like when you pass a truck on the highway. It appears to move backwards relative to yourself, just briefly, even though you're both going in the same direction. So that's retrograde motion. All there is right around the time that Mars is closest to us is just when we're passing it, and it seems to slip backwards and move the wrong way against the background stars for a few weeks.
Right, and it's out of it now. We've already passed that time now.
So correct. It's back to direct motion now. It's in, and you're right. It's right there in Taurus near Aldebaran, and it was a nice straight line of orange objects a little while ago. So you're a good observer.
Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And the email address is voxpopwamc.org. And Bob Berman joins us today. Roger in Albany. Roger, you're on.
Hi, Bob. Thanks. My question has to do with an Einstein test of general relativity. What causes the precession of the perihelia of planets in their orbits?
Right. And it's true that the difference in the predicted precession in the orbit of Mercury is what led to the proof of Einstein's relativity. So you're absolutely right about that. As the planets go around the sun, they all travel an elliptical path. So there's one spot when they're closest to the sun, and then they when they're also going fastest, so they whip around the sun and then go slower and slower. So it's an oval or egg-shaped or elliptical orbit, but it doesn't always face in the same direction. It changes its orientation in space. The moon does that, too. The moon has a 18.61-year change in its in how its orbit is facing. So it's not just the moon that's going around Earth. The actual orbit swings around Earth as well. So all the planets and the satellites of planets, they all do this. And it has to do with the gravity of the main planet. And as it goes around, there's just a little bit of a nudge to swing it around, because nothing really is stationary. And there's a little bit of a difference between the Newtonian idea of how the perihelion would precess and Einstein's idea, and Einstein proved to be right. So that was the proof. Finally shown in the great eclipse of May of 19. You know, Ray, I'm not doing that great with numbers today, but I think it was May of 1918. That eclipse was the one that made him a household name.
Well, yeah, I mean, Einstein wasn't around in 1818, so you're probably right.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Roger, thanks a lot for that test question. Let's go to Mel and Willow. Mel, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question concerns the exact mechanism of star formation. How does an inchoate mass of gas and dust assume a spherical shape and then a certain structure which has at its core an engine that transforms hydrogen items into helium items? How does that transformation occur?
Hey, Mel, do you have your radio on? Or are you in a train
station? Yes, I do. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
let me shut the door.
That would be great. Yeah, okay. And meanwhile, Bob can work on his answer to this question.
Yeah, yep. I heard your question, and the star initially forms from simple gravity, so you have a cloud of hydrogen gas or a nebula minding its own business in space. But every atom of this gas is pulling on every other, and so they're slowly condensing, and the process speeds up until it becomes a ball. Why always a ball? Why not a cube or a dodecahedron? Because spheres have the smallest surface area of any geometric shape. Only a sphere has every point on its surface being as close to the center as possible, and nothing's further away from the center than anything else. So if you're going to be pulled in by your own gravity, you're always going to form a ball, and that's why everything, planets and stars and everything, forms balls, unless there's too little mass to do the job. Only skimpy asteroids and such, very small moons that just didn't have enough weight to have enough gravity to pull themselves into balls, end up with odd shapes. So that's how you get the ball shape. And then how do you get that that nuclear fusion process to work that was first discovered and announced by Arthur Eddington in 1920? Well, you have a temperature that always goes up. This process of contraction increases the temperature. And finally, you get a temperature hot enough so that the hydrogen atoms are slamming into each other fast enough so that you eventually get four hydrogen atoms that make up a helium in that process of nuclear fusion.
What do you think, Mel?
Well, that's a very clear explanation, and I very much appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Ah, satisfied customer. Hey, Bob, let's take a break on that happy note. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Bob Berman. We'll be back with more astronomy. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Joy is in Maybrook. Hello, Joy.
Hello. Hello. I wanted to say we drove from Hudson Valley to Nashville, north of Nashville, to see the eclipse, and it was unbelievable. We met. We saw so many campers of all kinds. The traffic was terrible. We couldn't get to the park that we were going to because it was overflowed by 8 o'clock. So we had like a impromptu tailgate party at the hotel with lots of other people. And when that silence came, the whole crowd was quiet.
Wow.
And the air was so still. And it was just phenomenal. And then when the sun came back out, everybody started cheering, partying again. But it just still gives me the chills just thinking about it.
Oh, that's great. Great to hear. And for people who are listening and planning ahead to the eclipse in our area on April 8th, 2024, let me just mention that don't bother with a telescope, but do bring binoculars, any pair you happen to have at home, because during totality, and only use it when the sun is totally eclipsed. If you even take a moment's glance at it when it's only a partial eclipse, you can really lose your eyesight. But when it's total, binoculars are just the best tool for it, because then you'll really see those pink, like geysers, flames shooting out of the sun's edge, and other phenomena too that you can see fine naked eye. But if there's an enhancement, if there's an improvement to be had, well, the best one would be through ordinary binoculars.
Yes, my husband gave me his welding helmet.
Good.
Stylish.
Oh, I'm so glad you went. Yeah,
I would recommend it. Oh, so am I. And the funniest thing is when we were checking in the hotel, it was like one partner was, this is the chance of a lifetime. And the other partner's going, who knows? You know,
yeah.
It's like the difference on who thought it was going to be fabulous and who didn't. But afterwards, everyone was talking to each other about how awesome it was.
That's tremendous.
And the important thing is you got clear skies, didn't you?
Yes, we had clear skies down there. They were renting stadium seats at the arena for $40. But we had perfect clear skies, and it got dark, and the night lights went on, and the street lights. And
so cool.
It was just phenomenal. So I recommend it.
I'm so glad for you.
Joy, thanks a lot for the call. Now, you know, she brings up a point, though. She had a welder's helmet, her husband's welder's helmet, and you say, okay, yeah, you can look with binoculars at the total eclipse, but if you let it go 1 second too long, you're going to fry your retinas or something close to it. There is no timer. There's nobody standing there saying, okay, get ready, stop watching. How do you, I mean, there have to be people who watch too long and end up really doing damage.
Well, you know, you're right. It's a bit of an art as well as a science. And for the welder's goggles, and by the way, ordinary welder's goggles won't quite do the job. You want, like, darker ones than normal. You want shade 12 or 14. We like 12s ourselves, but either of those two shades will work just fine. Don't use 10s. As most welders would use 10s, those won't give you enough eye protection. And once again, those are only for the partial phase. Every total solar eclipse is preceded by an hour-long partial phase where the moon is only partially covering the sun. That's the part where you need those welder's goggles for. Once it's total, you not only can look at it with no eye protection, but that's when the binoculars come in handy.
Right, but again, my point is, who is there to tell everyone who may be sitting in a parking lot of a motel in Nashville to say, okay, now you can look at it straight up, or now you have to stop because in 1 second you're going to see some sun and do damage. This is what I'm concerned about.
You're absolutely right. When it's the early part is a little bit easier because you're using welder's goggles. The sun has gotten smaller and smaller, crescent shaped, and smaller, so you know totality is not too far away. And by the way, during that final minute before totality, the best view may be just looking around you at the countryside. Not even looking toward the sun because everything has such an eerie, otherworldly appearance. Shadows are very crisp-edged. Contrast is turned up. There's a high degree of polarization. It's like the ordinary world. Street lamps and cars don't look ordinary. They look like from another planet. So, but at what point can you look at the sun?
Yeah.
And so what I'd recommend is quick, momentary glances up when the sun has become only a little tiny, tiny sun that's left. You won't hurt your eyes with like a fraction of a second quick glance.
Okay.
But on the other hand, you don't want to miss the beginning of totality. You
right.
don't want to miss any of it. So quick glances, and then when it's total, you'll see it because the corona will be out and the sun will no longer be blindingly bright.
Right.
Same thing on the tail end of it a few minutes later. You've been watching the total eclipse, and there'll come a point, everyone experiences this, and you're watching with just your eye now, when a spot, a pinpoint of light comes back, full brightness, that's called the diamond ring effect.
Ah.
You don't want to miss that. You don't want to look away too soon because you do want to see the diamond ring effect. But the moment you see that, even though you might be aching to keep looking because it's so darn gorgeous. No, at the moment you see the diamond ring effect, that's your signal.
Okay.
Stop looking directly.
Bob Berman is our guest. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. Bob is in Broad Alban. Bob, you're on.
Thank you. I'm curious to know if the astronomers theorists find a relationship between what Frank Wittert, the Nobel Prize winner, describes as the dark matter axion, of course, dark matter having magnetic characteristics, and the magnet, the graviton. The Higgs boson is a phenomenon that can be related to the magnetic particle, the graviton, but not necessarily so with dark matter. And what Wittek calls the axion dark matter particle. Do you find a correlation relationship? Is there a mathematical relation?
No, because so far this is theoretical. For example, the graviton that you mentioned should be the force-carrying particle for the gravitational force. You know, there's only four forces, and each of them has a particle that brings it from somewhere to somewhere else. The weak atomic force, for example, is carried by bosons, the strong force by gluons. The electromagnetic force is conveyed by photons, ordinary photons.
Ah.
And the gravitational force by, as you say, the graviton, but they've never been found. And so they still remain theoretical. Now, so far as dark matter goes, dark matter is even theoretical, and it shows itself only by its effect gravitationally. So we don't know what it is, let alone know what a force carrying particle, even if it exists, would be for dark matter. We know it only because our galaxy spins strangely, and there are neighbor galaxies that are moving so fast they should escape from our group, but they don't. So some kind of gravitational force is gluing things together, and there appears to be eight times more gravity in the universe than can be explained by all the stars and black holes and planets and dust and anything else we can think of. So we call that dark matter. But giving it a name doesn't mean we know what it is, because the guesses are everywhere, from a new kind of particle, subatomic particle that has a lot of mass but no visibility, to could be baseballs, millions of baseballs there. You know, unlikely. So we really don't know what it is.
All right, Bob, thank you very much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. And this email came in from Drew. And this is along the same lines. Drew writes, can Bob give us an explanation, as to how scientists have mapped dark matter. I tried explaining it to my brother, did a terrible job. I'm sure you can do much better. Bob, can you do much better?
Yeah, I'll go a little bit further from the previous call. The two main ideas are the way our galaxy spins. Normally, you'd expect it to spin the way solar systems do. You know, Pluto dashes around the sun once every 88 days. Did I say Pluto? Mercury does that, while Pluto, all the way at the edges of the solar system, take 248 years. So in other words, it's moving much more slowly.
Yeah.
Our galaxy doesn't do that. The inner part of the galaxy does not, well, the very inner one does, because we've got a 4 million solar mass black hole there. But generally, the beginnings, the closer parts in to the galaxy, don't rotate faster than the outer ones. Rather, we spin uniformly like a vinyl record. So the only explanation that would make sense is if there's about 8 times more gravity than all the things that we know of. And so we call that dark matter. But are these particles? Are these a new form of matter? And then there's an alternate theory called MOND, which says, no, dark matter doesn't exist, and it's just gravity itself behaving strangely at low levels. That low levels of gravity don't fall off inversely with the square of distance the way gravity normally does, but behave oddly. And then if that's true, then you don't need to have dark matter at all.
Very interesting indeed. Bob Berman is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. Judy is in New Paltz. Hello, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to tell you, Bob, that we took your class a couple of years ago up there in Willow. We had so much fun.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yes. What I wanted to share with you is I was horseback riding with a friend during the partial eclipse in 2017 up at Mohonk. And one horse totally flipped out because every single leaf of every tree was a crescent shadow on the ground, moving and flittering. And it was so interesting that this very calm horse just was feeling something going on that wasn't quite part of his life.
So interesting.
Wow. Stargazing horses. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Thanks, Judy.
Thanks for sharing that. Thank you.
This email came in from Jay, and Jay says, this morning around 5:40 a.m., sky was brightening. Only thing visible, a bright star high in the sky. What was it?
Now, at that hour high in the sky,
Yes. You
could have still had Capella up there. Low in the sky, too bad you didn't say low in the sky, because Jupiter is returning, and so is Saturn, but they're down in Capricornus, and they're low in the sky at that hour. And if you had said in the east, also low, there is Venus, still a trace of Venus left. That's as bright as anything, but that's low in the sky. So high up, well, you know what? It was probably Arcturus, the famous orange star. If it was orange, then the answer would be Arcturus.
You know, we were out on Easter night, and it was a beautiful night, about 8 o'clock, 8:10, and we see a light coming up from the west, and we watched this thing. We said, oh, gosh, this isn't a plane. This is just a very, very bright light, and it seems way up there, and it's moving at a pretty good clip. It's the space station. Found out the other day it was, in fact, the space station, and that is a sight to see as well.
Oh, yes, it is. It is, and I recommend all of our listeners, if you're interested in seeing it for yourself, just type in a search, spot the space station, and they'll calculate it for you. NASA will send you emails the morning of any evening that the space station will pass over your house. It'll tell you what direction to look and how high it'll get. It's a free service.
You know, one of the things that really caught my attention with this, I mean, we watch satellites all the time, and you can see them, they fade out fairly quickly, especially the, what are those strings of satellites that Musk is throwing up in the air now, the Starlinks, and they'll fade. You watch them in a line, and they fade. This thing went almost across the whole, it was about 7 minutes we watched this thing. How high up do you have to be, even at 10 after 8 at night, to reflect that much sun for that long?
Yeah, it's about 251 miles up, And you're right. It usually starts in view about only 10 degrees up from one horizon, usually the northwest, and then it'll cross the sky and disappear when it's about 10 degrees above the opposite horizon around the eastern sky when it goes into Earth's shadow. So, yeah, got a long period of visibility. I know just which night you were watching, too, because I was watching
Sunday
that
night.
Same night.
Yeah, it was amazing.
The way you're describing it, I know the night. It's quite a thrill, and it's quite bright. I mean, as you undoubtedly observed, it was as bright as the dog star Sirius, wasn't it?
No, and it was spectacular, and it doesn't change. In other words, it's coming toward you, and it's the same luminance as it is when it's going away. It's very impressive, and that alone makes it very obviously not a plane. Let's go to John in Liberty. John.
Hi. I just have a quick question about black holes. I know we suspect that they're collapsed stars, dense space. Has any thought been given to time? I always just wondered if there are holes in the sense of an actual true hole, could that energy be going backwards in time towards what we refer to as the Big Bang?
You know, your thoughts, as strange as they sound, really have validity to them, because it's true in the strong gravitational field of a black hole, in fact, the infinitely strong, time does change. But it wouldn't be backwards in time toward the Big Bang. The way it would happen is that as the final material is collapsing to form a black hole, black holes have to have at least 8 times the weight or mass of our sun to have enough self-gravity to collapse to be a black hole. But if you were there, those final few seconds of collapse will occur very quickly. In just a few seconds, the star would collapse and become the density needed for a black hole. But here's a crazy part, and this involves your question. From the outside perspective, from the rest of the universe, for us watching this thing, time passes so differently that it doesn't proceed, that the star's collapse freezes. In fact, this is why they used to call these frozen stars before the name black hole was more popular. And the collapse of the star freezes in place because time has to pass infinitely from the outsider's perspective, and the whole rest of the universe is outside the black hole. Infinite time has to pass before this thing can achieve black hole density and size. And, of course, infinite time hasn't yet passed. It never will. So in a real sense, black holes cannot form in our universe unless you're right there, unless you're part of the black hole. To any observer, the whole rest of the universe, it freezes and stops before it can ever quite become a black hole because of this time change that you were just talking about.
I'm so glad you brought this up at the end of the show. Otherwise, I would never be able to make it through the show. Richard in Bird Hills. Richard, you're on. You only got about a minute here.
Hi. Okay, thank you. I'll try to make it quick. I would agree that there is no dark matter. Have you guys, and I just started listening 10 minutes ago, have you heard of the electric universe theory? The electromagnetic force is thousands of times stronger than gravity and can easily account for the stuff we've seen. And I didn't come up with this myself. There's a famous guy from GE who figured this out. I just threw out his name. I just Googled it. David Talbot and a Wallace Thornhill. But they've done experiments that are able to mimic the spiral galaxies. Just a quick example, if you take a comb and a balloon, there's gravity attracting a comb and a balloon together, but it's so weak you could never measure it. But you rub that comb on the balloon, and that balloon will come and, you know, stick to the comb. So if you haven't researched that, please look into the electric universe theory. It's fascinating.
What do you think, Bob? The electric universe.
Well, I don't want to end this whole show on a negative note, and people do send me things about this electric universe business from time to time. Just from my comment, you can tell that I'm skeptical.
Yes.
But always worth investigating, I guess.
Well, that's a cop out. Why don't you give us your real opinion? You got 15 seconds.
it would require more than that, because even though the different forces, the four forces have different strengths, the infinite reach of gravity still seems much more persuasive. And the electromagnetic force is something, when you're talking about electrostatic charges and others, we don't really see their effect, even on a planetary level. We don't see such things very much, even on planets, let alone on scales like that.
Well, Bob, you have done it. You have managed to get through this entire program. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ray.
Support comes from Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans. Hand-picked selection of wines, single malts, and small-batch bourbons. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. And watercolors by Edith Schutzbury. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors. Paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs. No contact required. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman for being here. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones were answered by a real bigwig at the station, Jessica Denyeau, who didn't look all that pleased to be here, but thank you all the same. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday, and oh boy, we welcome back a real favorite. Rick Orlando joins us, and that's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Capitol Connection.